Okay, so this is the last of the lectures on interpretations. Bindiya, how many lectures are there after this? Just one lecture? Is that right?
No.
Just Monday. Okay, I have so much more to say. Okay. Well, we'll talk about collapse models today. Then on Monday I'll just cram everything else into that one lecture. So the idea here is that you take seriously the idea that the wave function collapses, and you modify your equations so that the wave function doesn't just evolve unitarily according to the Schrödinger equation forever, but it will undergo collapse. And the person who originally did this was Philip Perl. And then the paper that's probably the most famous on this subject, or was studied at least, is the GRW. That's Gherardi, Rimini, Weber. And the particular version of the model I'm going to present is a reinterpretation, or at least a clarification, perhaps, of the GRW model by John Bell. Okay, so here's the basic idea. So the motivation is to solve the measurement problem by explicitly modifying Schrödinger's equation. And you want to do it so that you have the following kind of behavior. If you have a small object, so a few quantum particles, a small number of quantum particles, then you want that the behavior due to this modified Schrödinger equation is essentially, it's hardly changed. That the small object will behave as it would pretty much if the Schrödinger equation were as it was originally. So. So this means that for small objects, you'll still see quantum interference and all the quantum entanglement. You'll still see the usual quantum effects that you expect, which have been verified in experiments. Whereas for a large object, and by a large object he means something which is, like a measurement apparatus, something which has Avogadro's number of particles roughly, then you want the evolution to be strongly influenced by this modification. Thank you. And in particular, you want the modification to be such that if you have some macroscopic object in a superposition, it very quickly collapses, so it's no longer in a superposition. So a pointer state, for example, on a measurement apparatus should very quickly collapse. And this is a modification of quantum theory. However, it would be hard, one imagines, to actually to actually see this modification, because it's very difficult to do quantum interference or quantum entanglement experiments with large objects. So it should still be consistent with the physics we know, and at the same time solve the measurement problem. Furthermore, there is a possible justification for something like this coming from quantum gravity. If you imagine trying to combine general relativity and quantum theory, then you can argue that actually something like this ought to happen, or at least that kind of argument has been put forward by Diossi and also by Penrose, Roger Penrose. And so I'll give you Penrose's argument. So imagine you have some mass, not a microscopic mass, maybe a mesoscopic mass. Anyway, a sufficiently big mass, and you put it into a superposition, a quantum superposition of being in two places. So. So it's sort of either here or here. Okay. And since this mass is quite big, it will induce some kind of change in the metric field that surrounds it. And so you'll have, I'll use this orange chalk here, corresponding to this mass here, that's meant to represent the metric field. As a position of x, this is for this particle if it's in position one. And if it's in position two, you would get a different metric field because this is in a different location. So you get some different metric field. Okay, using green chalk now, which would be induced by that position. So for position two. And so now Roger Penrose's argument is like this, that you've got these two different solutions. And you want to think about how to evolve the quantum state forward in time. So that means you want to be able to identify points x in one solution, say the orange solution, with points x in the other solution, the green solution, so that you can then foliate and get a consistent time to evolve this forward. However, there is no unique or way of identifying points between two different manifolds with solutions on them. There's no way of identifying points between these two solutions. It could be the same manifold, but there's different solutions. So there's no, and this is because of diffeomorphism invariance. There's no unique way, certainly, and these are just two different solutions. You can't really say that this point in this one corresponds to that point in that solution. And so Penrose argues there's no consistent way to do this, and so there's a kind of conflict between having a superposition of a mass being in two places and the basic principles of general relativity. And so then Penrose argues that something has got to give, and he suggests the thing that gives is the idea that you have a superposition, so that there has to be a collapse, he argues, in this situation. It's a rather heuristic argument. It's not fully convincing, I don't think, but it's certainly plausible. Go ahead.
I think I missed. Why does something have to give?
You want to identify points between these two different manifolds, so you can foliate and then evolve the wave function forward in time. But there's no way. there's no given mapping between these two different solutions, because if you have a point in this one, there's no way of saying that point corresponds to some point in the other solution. There's no consistent way of mapping between the two solutions, because you have this property of diffeomorphism invariance. In the literature on general relativity, you'll come across a thing called the hole problem. You haven't probably covered that in any of your courses. It's something that people into quantum gravity take very seriously. What it ends up telling you is that the label X doesn't really have any intrinsic meaning. It only derives its meaning through the properties of the fields at that point. It doesn't have intrinsic meaning in itself. Classically, you might think of position as being something that's laid out there. There's this kind of background that's given, and then you put fields on top of them. Much like if you have a canvas and you put paint on top of it, the canvas is pre-existing and you put the paint on top of it. That's not really consistent with the way general relativity works. There's no sense in saying that you have a given point in space-time independently of the fields that are there. And so if you're trying to identify points between this space, between this solution and this one, there's no unique or sensible way of doing that. Go ahead.
Are we basically saying that can't reach a compromise or some average of those two rather than...
Yeah, that's what Penrose is saying. Now, more recently, various people, including myself, have tried to do that. What the approach I've taken is to say, well, actually what you can do is you can identify points between these different solutions, but regard that identification as gauge. So you can choose one identification or another identification. It's just a sort of convenient choice you make in order to describe the physics, and then you proceed in that way. I proposed something called the quantum equivalence principle, which uses these kinds of ideas. You'll find a paper on the archive. People from Vienna, Bruckner and Giacomini, worked on this as well. or Flaminia Giacomini, who's a postdoc here, and now she's in Geneva, but she started in Vienna. So there are some modern responses to this kind of approach, but this is an argument that is often invoked to say that there should be collapse coming from quantum gravity. It's an interesting argument, I think. Okay. And Penrose argues that there's a certain time scale for this collapse, because it couldn't happen instantly, because then you just wouldn't have any quantum theory. So he suggests that the time scale is T is equal to H bar over E delta. Diossi has something similar. And then the E delta is something you calculate by looking at the mass distributions in these two different solutions. I could write down an expression for that, although I'm not sure it's very... I won't bother writing. There's a certain expression for this that Penrose writes down to do with the mass distribution in these different solutions. So that's the idea. That maybe this is the compromise you talk of. The collapse doesn't necessarily happen straight away, but it happens on some time scale.
I was more talking about position or the properties collapsing into a common compromise rather than...
Oh, right, yeah, no. So definitely you collapse into one or the other. Yeah. Right.
That's
yeah.
The odd thing, is you don't find a compromise.
Yeah. Now, there is an approach, semi-classical quantum gravity, where you... I think it's one of those sort of toy theories that... a straw man that people put up to show it doesn't work. And there you do imagine something like a compromise, but it just fails for very trivial reasons. Because, you know, if you have a mass here in a superposition with a mass here, and now you send another particle between them, okay, well, if the mass was just here, the particle would be deflected this way by the gravitational field. Or if the mass is just here, it would be reflected that way. But if you take this sort of certain semi-classical approximation, you imagine it just will be end up being averaged out. And just going straight through, because the two things will cancel. But that just makes no sense, you know, from the point of view of linearity in quantum theory, you'd expect an entanglement between this and this and this and that, you know. So it makes no sense. You kind of have to choose it. Okay. So what I want to do then is talk about an explicit collapse model. The GLW one. And I'll talk about it in the Bell presentation. And so Bell presented this at a conference, first presented this at a conference at Imperial College in London in 1987. And I was finishing my undergraduate degree there, so I happened to be in the audience. Yeah. I didn't understand it at the time, but well, here I am. A number of years later, presenting it. So, first of all, we want to say what the ontology is. And the ontology consists of two parts. This is a bit curious. One is a wave function. This is very much like the de Broglie-Bohm model. I'm using the notation from Bell's paper. So the positions denoted by R1 through to Rn. And then the second thing, B, is a way to get local bubbles. I'll explain what I mean by that. So bubbles was a word invented by John Bell. It means, well, bubbles, things that are able to be. So basically, it's just a way of talking about things that are ontological, things that are elements of reality. But then you put the word local in front, and the thought there is that it's not enough just to have some very non-local thing. You also need a way to talk about what actually what is local in real space. So in three space, this thing lives in configuration space. So what are the things that we see local in space? And then there are two proposals, one due to Bell, which is that you have what he called what's been called the flash ontology. So, as you'll see, what's going to happen is that this wave function will be subject to quantum jumps. These are kind of collapse events. And these jumps will happen in three space. Okay, and they will be centered on a certain location. And Bell wants those jumps to be part of the ontology. In addition to the wave function, you also have these flash events that are an additional part of the ontology. And then a different proposal is due to Girardi. So Girardi is the G here, and he was the main advocate of this kind of approach. So he was in Trieste in northern Italy. So he's no longer alive, but there's a group there in Trieste that continues to pursue collapse models. And his idea instead was a kind of mass density approach. So the difference is, in Bell's case, the flashes are something which are in addition to the wave function, whereas Girardi uses the wave function to calculate a kind of local mass density and to get the local bubbles in that way. Okay. Okay, and then, so that's the first thing we need is the ontology. And then we need also the dynamics. And the dynamics are that you have Schrödinger evolution except when jump events occur. And I'll write down the various equations that describe how this happens. But the basic idea is that the wave function is evolving according to the Schrödinger equation. And then every so often, any given particle has a certain probability of being subject to a jump event. And when that jump event occurs, random times, then the whole wave function is multiplied by a Gaussian which affects the given particle, and that will cause the whole wave function to collapse. So that's the basic idea. I'll show you in more detail how it works. Okay. Let's So first of all, the probability per unit time per particle for a jump is 1 over tau. And tau is a new constant of nature, a new fundamental constant of nature, according to this model. And so these jumps are distributed with some kind of Poisson distribution. So you can do a calculation to see how many events will happen in some time t. So that's some time t. And that will just be given by some appropriate expression. I'll write it down. I don't think you need to think about that too much, just that it's a Poisson distribution. So that's the first point. Second point is that the jump has a certain effect on the wave function. Remember, we've chosen a particular particle, so we've chosen at random. I'll just write it. So we choose small n randomly from 1 to large n, just with a flat distribution, equal probability. And then we apply this. Haven't finished yet. There's more to say here. So x here is going to be is the jump center. I'll explain more about that later. And so you want to choose the jump center also randomly. According to a distribution which I'll give you. Thank you. Oh, and sorry, I've missed off an important point here. So after this jump process, you have to normalize the state afterwards. So this whole thing is divided by a normalization factor. Like so. Now, you could try different choices for this this jump operator here, this thing that causes that you multiply the wave function by. But the choice, the usual choice that's used, is this. So you multiply the wave function by a Gaussian. And you'll notice there's a constant here, A. A is another fundamental constant of nature. So the constant tau tells you how often you have these collapse events. The constant A tells you the sort of width of the Gaussian that multiplies. So basically it gives you a length scale for these collapse events. I'll show you some examples just so you can see how this works. Okay. And then finally, I need to talk about the distribution for these jump centers. Sorry, I'm just there's one thing I didn't define here, which was Rn. So Rn of x all squared is given by this expression. So you take the integral in this configuration space over J over the thing you have here, over this thing. Squared. So this gives you the modulus squared. You can just take, you just find anything that's consistent with that to put in the denominator here, because this thing is only meaningful up to overall phase anyway. And so now I want to talk about the probability distribution for x. with okay, so this is a probabilistic distribution, and you choose the clap center randomly according to that. Actually, one thing you want to do to make this work is to normalize J. Okay, so that normalization just gives you some value for K in the expression for J. Okay, so just talking through it one more time, we have we choose a particle randomly, and then we choose a position x randomly according to this distribution, and then we hit the wave function, and so afterwards the wave function is equal to this, where this J is a Gaussian. Okay, that's the model. So I want to show you now that this model will do the two things I said originally. For small systems, it will leave them hardly affected at all. And for large systems, it will get rid of macroscopic superpositions. Okay. Is the model clear? Okay. Oh, just one more point here. We have these two fundamental constants. So GRW, when they wrote their paper back in the 80s, suggested that tau is equal to 10 to the 15 seconds, which is about 10 to the 8 years. And they suggested that A is equal to 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. So the idea is that this is an incredibly long time, so an individual particle will hardly be affected at all. Whereas if you have Avogadro's number of particles, then the probability of a collapse is then the number of particles multiplied by, is then n over tau. And so this number becomes, this probability becomes much bigger. I should say, this becomes the characteristic thing that determines it. Obviously, that can be bigger than one, but in the equation I gave you here, that's the thing that controls it. Okay. So let's discuss a single particle. So imagine we have some particle. This is the x-axis, and the wave function is something like this. You might have this if you have an interferometer and you're looking at the particle when it's sort of when it's midway through the interferometer. So you have a superposition of being in two places. And we'll imagine that this distance here is much greater than A. And this distance here is much less than A. And now, every 100 million years, this particle is going to get hit by this jump process, and the wave function will be multiplied by a Gaussian. The Gaussian will be centered, will be chosen with probability, which is, you know, the probability is the probability density is zero here because there's no amplitude here, and it's sort of maximum over here and over here. So the probability density, so that x is most likely to be chosen either here or over here. So if I make these two things equal, then there's a 50% chance of the collapse center being chosen over here and a 50% chance of it being chosen over here. And then the Gaussian, say the collapse center is this point, say that's x, then you have to multiply this by a Gaussian. The width of the Gaussian is much bigger than the width of this wave packet. So it's something like this. And so over the vicinity of this, over where this wave packet is non-zero, the Gaussian is pretty much constant in value. Though not quite. So so this wave packet will be slightly affected, but not at all, not much at all, really. Whereas this wave packet will go to zero. So when that collapse event occurs, once in 100 million years, you'll end up with this term remaining and this term essentially going to zero. Now, it's not exactly zero because this tail has a very long tail, but it's pretty much zero. Okay. I mention that because some people worry about this long tail, and I can talk about that later. Okay, is that clear? Any questions? Yep, go ahead.
How did they estimate these constants?
So what they did was, back then, is they just said, well, I want to make sure tau is sufficiently big that it won't affect, you know, the sort of experiments we have already, and they just chose that number. But they wanted it to be that if you multiply that by Avogadro's number, then you get a collapse very quickly, so that the time scale, this for something remaining in a superposition is incredibly, you know, it will collapse very quickly. They could have chosen different numbers. And here, A, they chose it to be like this because that's a bit smaller than the human eye can discern, certainly my human eyes, whereas it's a lot bigger than the sort of typical quantum processes. There's been experimental work done, and I don't know I won't be able to tell you the latest on this, but it's possible to constrain these numbers looking at experimental data. In particular, one thing you'll see is if you hit a bunch of atoms, a bunch of hydrogen atoms, if they're all in the ground state, and then they get hit by these Gaussians, there's some very small probability that they'll get excited to a higher state, and then they will decay and release photons, and so you can use that calculation to put a limit given experimental data on these parameters tau and A. And my understanding is that actually these particular values are now ruled out, but you can still choose values that are sensible and not ruled out by data. Yep.
So this jump model seems to describe some sort of an interaction. So how do we interpret this?
Like interaction? What interaction between what and what?
I don't know, but it seems like the psi is interacting with something, and then it's
okay. So one attitude you could take is that some field out there that's interacting with psi, and that's what, you know, every so often it causes the collapse, and, you know, you might posit that's something gravitational, perhaps. Or you could just say, no, this is the model, I've described it, do your calculations and see what happens, and not think of it as something that's fundamental.
But it does introduce fundamental constants.
It introduces fundamental constants, and it introduces experimental implications as well. It's one of the problems with this model is it's very ad hoc. You've just chosen something, and you know, that's not the worst thing because you're just trying to show this is possible in principle. However, it would be much more satisfactory if something like this was a consequence of some deeper principles, and we don't have that.
Are all these capital N particles similar in terms of size and energy?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very basic model where you're just imagining a whole bunch of, let's say, similar particles. You might try to apply this to different types of particles, and then you could say that that you know electrons might have a different tau to or a different a and a different tau to quarks or something like this. You could try, but this is really just to show that you can write down these models. So it becomes a plausible way of solving the measurement problem. Okay, so next I should show you, to kind of complete the story, I need to show you what it does to a measurement apparatus. Okay, I'll do this. And then, so now imagine we have a measurement apparatus. It has a particle, so here's the box, has a pointer, which is initially in the zero position, and a particle comes in and goes out. Okay. And then afterwards, that evolves to a situation where you have a particle, you have the pointer going to the left, and the particle passing through, or the pointer going to the right. Okay, that's very schematic notation there. To write that down in less schematic notation, we could have something like this. So the initial state is the system going in state psi, and then we have the measurement apparatus initially in its zero state. And then afterwards, we have we can write psi down as a sum of its eigenvalues, eigenstates. Sorry, as sum of its eigenstates, and then pass it through. And so afterwards, we have this. And here I'm using kets. But the whole model is in terms of wave functions. So let me write that down again. Let's write this as alpha, and then I'll let A be some function of R1, the particle. Let's assume this is particle 1 that comes in. So this is a function of R1. And then I'll let the pointer, this is a very basic model here, be a product state of each of the particles in some wave packet. So the pointer consists of particles 2 through n. So we're imagining you have some A, some wave packet that's localized, this is a mistake. This should be 1. This is if the pointer is localized over here, and then we'll have the same kind of thing and this should be 1, and this is 2. Like so. So this is some wave packet. Each of these are some wave packet that's localized on the left-hand side. These ones are wave packets that are localized on the right-hand side. And we have kind of this one, it's the power, you know, we have it sort of, I'm not sure how to notate this, but n minus 1 times. And then we have this one. N minus 1 times. Okay. So the picture is we have either the pointer on the left and the product state we take, and the state we take it to just be a product state of lots of wave packets for each of the individual particles, or the pointer on the right, which we take to be a product state of lots of individual particles. And so, okay, and this is just a simplified approach, because in reality, if you have a pointer, the positions are correlated with one another, whereas we're just taking it to be one product state. If you were to do a better treatment where the positions were correlated, you'd get the same result. I just want to simplify things for this discussion. Is that model clear? Okay. And now what's going to happen is, well, n is now very big, because there's going to be roughly 10 to the 23 particles in there. And so very quickly, you're going to see a collapse. And the collapse will be centered either on the left-hand side or the right-hand side with high probability. It's unlikely to be in the middle. And if the collapse happens on the left-hand side, you'll pick out one of the particles. Most likely, it's going to be one of the particles in the pointer, because most of the particles in the pointer. So one of these particles in the pointer will be picked out. You'll multiply the whole wave packet by a Gaussian with argument corresponding to that one particle that was picked out. And so that Gaussian will barely affect the particle wave packet that you picked out on the left, but it will, if the collapse center is on the left, it will barely affect this wave packet, but it will kill the wave packet on the right. And because you have this, because of the nature of this state, that basically kills the whole thing. If you just kill any one of these terms, you're killing the whole state. So this whole state will go down to pretty much zero. And this state will be pretty much unaffected. So that causes the whole pointer to collapse onto the left-hand side. It could instead have happened that it collapsed on the right-hand side. And the probability, this isn't obvious, but the probability will work out to be mod alpha squared for collapsing onto the left-hand side, and mod beta squared for collapsing onto the right-hand side. So that's the story. And that's how you solve the measurement problem, that after a very short amount of time, the pointer is definitely in one state or the other. Any questions? Is that clear? Good. So let me just finally, because we're at the 1 hour break, let me just finally talk about the criticisms of this model. One criticism is that it's been hard to make this consistent with covariance, to make it sort of relativistic. And the reason for that is kind of clear, that you've got this non-local instantaneous collapse. So it's clear that something very non-covariant is going on. A second criticism is that the model is very ad hoc. It's been designed to do what they wanted to do, which is solve the measurement problem. But it's not derived from any fundamental principles. And then the third criticism interesting one. So there's some discussion of this in the literature, which is that you have these tails. So when you collapse over here, you still have a very, very small tail for the particle being over here. Okay, so you don't actually fully kill the other term in the superposition. Now the beta, or the coefficient in front of it, becomes incredibly small, but it's still there. And then you have the same kind of problem I raised in the context of the de Broglie-Bohm model, which is that this tail still exists, and it has all the structure of the world in it. It has a kind of story to tell, where you have, you know, people and things and all the usual story that exists in this wave function if you dig around and look for it. It hasn't truly gone. And just because it has a small amplitude in front of it doesn't mean it's still not there and part of the ontology. And so people have worried about that. Any questions on that interpretation? Yeah, go ahead.
Why don't instead of multiplying by a Gaussian, we just multiply by like a bump function?
Yeah, so I think people have tried that kind of thing, and then actually I haven't seen explicit discussion of a bump function, but I think people have tried things with compact support, and I think it affects the energy production. You know, I mentioned how if you have atoms and they get hit by this jump process, then they can get excited to a higher state, and I think it affects those. But I'm not up to speed with the latest developments in this. The person who works on this is a guy. The main person who works on this in the theory side is a guy called Angelo Blasi in Trieste, and he might have better answers to that than I do. Yeah, go ahead.
Are there actual particles in this model, or just a wave function?
There's no. Well, the ontology is what I described. It's I may have moved the board, but it consists of the wave function, and then you have a choice. If you want to go with Bell, you have this jump centers. So that's a funny thing, because it's lots of little. You can think of it as lots of flashes. You know, jump center here, then here, like sort of just last for a fraction, you know, just last for an instant, dotted through space-time. Or you can go with this mass density ontology that Girardi came up with, where you integrate over the wave function to find some mass density living in real space. There's no actual particles. It's not like the de Broglie-Bohm model. No. Another question?
So this process seems to be competing with decoherence, because, you know, decoherence also kind of restricts the states which we can observe. So how does that influence the collapse process?
So, so there's a few things to say about this. So one thing to say is, from the point of view of the measurement problem, decoherence doesn't really solve the problem, in that it doesn't tell you that you get one outcome rather than the other, whereas collapse models do solve that problem, with the caveat of the tail thing I just raised. So there's a reason to go to collapse models rather than just relying on decoherence. On the other hand, if you're trying to do an experiment and you want to be sure that you're actually seeing collapse, then you're always fighting against decoherence, because it's very hard to isolate from the environment to be sure that the effect you're seeing is this fundamental collapse process rather than some decoherence. And that's always going to be a problem in doing real experiments. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So just before I finish, I have one question for you guys. So I've presented three different models. De Broglie-Bohm, many worlds, and collapse. There's a lot of models I haven't presented, like, you know, cubism and Copenhagen and so on. But of the three models I presented, I'm just curious as to what are people's favorites? What do people think is the best? So just a quick show of hands. So De Broglie-Bohm. I'm just going to write this down here. Is it three votes? One, two. One more person was voting for it. Did you vote? No. It's three votes. Good. Many worlds? Two. Collapse?
Yes.
You don't have to. Don't. It's no one's going to be upset. But one. Okay. And none of the above?
Well, this one. Collapse.
Sorry?
I was like more leaning towards collapse. So you can put
okay, you're more leaning towards collapse, so 1.5. and you can change that to 0.6 or something.
I would add in cubism as a choice.
Okay, I mean, I just haven't presented it, so it's hard to make people have a Okay, so others are, anyone, you said others, yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously this number might grow if you were to study the material. Okay, thanks. So I think we have one more lecture left, and I've gone terribly over time. I thought I had more lectures until I looked at the schedule. So I'm going to think over the weekend about what to put in that last lecture. There's a tremendous amount of research being done in quantum foundations since all this stuff, since the 80s. And so I'm hoping to do justice to some of that. Yeah.
One question. What have you learned since 1986 when you didn't understand this stuff?
All right.
What's the key takeaway for us so that we do understand it?
All right. I mean, I think they're all, it's good to study these models because I think they teach you something about quantum theory, and people have been motivated to do different things that have been useful for practical applications by these models. So the de Broglie-Bohm model was one of the things that motivated John Bell to think about non-locality. He asked if it had to be present. The many worlds motivated David Deutsch to think about quantum computing. I'm not sure explicitly if anything can be traced back to the collapse model, but by thinking about them, you understand quantum theory a bit deeper, that's something to take forward. But I don't believe, I don't believe any of them. I think I would add myself into this box. They're all fun, but I don't, you know. I don't know. I think we need to think about we need to find new ways to think about quantum foundations. And so that's what I've spent most of the last 30 years doing.
I'm not sure it's the case that when I voted, I believe them, but I wanted to find out more about them. I thought they were interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'm not holding anyone to this. I'm just curious. Okay.